You're listening to WCOM-FM, LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 on the dial, and live streaming from WCOMFM.org. Here's a reminder that the comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. From Main Street to Wall Street, the issues impacting your business, we're talking leadership, technology, politics, regulation, and success stories that inspire. It's time to focus on business. I'm your host, author, speaker, entrepreneur, and business consultant, Lee Strickland. I'm the CEO of Focus Resources and 2S Innovations and founder of the Network for Business Growth. I've also created the Core Business Transformation System. And now today's program. My guest today on Focus on Business is Lyle Gravett of the NK Patent Law with offices in Raleigh. And he is a patent attorney proficient in writing patent applications and has worked with a wide range of technologies related to patents: wireless detection, management systems, biotechnology, nanotech products, smart grid analytic and load control devices, consumer products, mechanical and manufacturing equipment, medical devices, and software applications. Lyle began his career as a patent analyst and a professional researcher and developed new software tools for advanced searching of patents and publications, and he now primarily focuses on the client service side of patent work. He has a BS in physics from Wake Forest University, and his law degree is from the University of Mississippi School of Law. And again, he's with NK Patent Law. Full disclosure, NK Patent Law is my patent attorney for my company, 2S Innovations. And Lyle, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
And we're going to talk about patent law. So first, what is a patent? What does it do? And what does it really mean for a business?
Thanks, Lee. Patent is a form of intellectual property law. There's several different types of intellectual property. We have copyrights, which protect written expressions and communications of information. We have trademarks, which aren't concerned with the content of the words, but more are for protecting symbols. And then we have patents, which deal with functional and design innovation.
So what can be patented?
A patent can protect a new and non-obvious idea. For example, we can patent a method, a composition of matter, a product. What cannot be patented are scientific ideas or abstract ideas.
We can patent a design of a chair or a design of a microphone, as long as it's not something that's already been in existence or patented.
That's right. One thing that you need to look at is what is already publicly available. In other words, what's out there in the public domain, and how does your design or products, how is it separate or distinguishable, or as the law would say, non-obvious over that quote-unquote prior art.
So in our area, we have a lot of researchers doing technological things and scientific, biological, medical, all those kind of things. So what makes one of those items, so like can you patent a genome? Can you patent an assay? What all can be patented, and are they only mechanical things? And what makes the distinction between what's patentable?
Right. So the distinction I guess we're looking for in those examples are, we have a genome, for example, is a scientific discovery. It's a product of nature, which was not necessarily invented by humans, but discovered or brought to light by humans. So while you can't necessarily patent a particular genome, you could patent a method of discovering the genome.
Okay.
Or creating a new non-natural genomic material.
So like if you created a synthetic genome of that, a replication of it, that would be patentable in many instances.
That's right. It meets the requirement of being non-natural. Then what we'd have to look at is, has somebody else done that before?
Okay.
Or has somebody done such a similar synthetic genome before that you would be considered obvious compared to it?
Well, and I have to disclose, you're my attorney on some patent things. And so what we've been working with are mechanical, hydraulic, electrical designs. And so where do the lines come into what's patentable and those kind of things? So if I design a new window blind, what has to be distinctive in that for me to be able to say that's new and not obvious? And how do we make those decisions? And what's that process for it? I have an idea. I draw it up. Maybe I even name it. And then what do I do, and how do I start trying to figure out Is it non-natural? Is it non-obvious? And all of those kind of things.
Well, I guess the first thing I should say is we should step back a little bit. And there's never a very clear answer as to, can I get a patent on this? It's about risk mitigation.
Okay.
The more upfront work you do, you can determine or you can mitigate your risk of
it not being patentable.
Of it not being patentable, right? So the first step would be identifying what is out there, what is publicly available, what was there before you created your invention.
So as an inventor or an idea person, if I just start Googling on the internet and I Google tables or I Google window blinds, and then I start seeing, and then I go to the USPTO website, and I can type in some words, and I can do a search and see with those words and terms I'm using and start getting a feel, right, for is this something I should take the next step and sit down with a patent attorney and say, hey, what do I do?
Absolutely. The first thing is you need a fully conceived idea. If you've identified a problem and you've identified a potential solution, you need to ask yourself, if you were to describe that solution to somebody else, would they be able to pick it up and run with it and make that product you're envisioning? If the answer is no, then you probably have a couple knowledge gaps to fill.
So you need to be precise, concise. You need a drawing, if you can draw it. You need a word description of what does it do, what problem does it solve, all of those kind of things, so that when I bring it to an attorney, and I always tell my clients, don't just discuss this with everybody, because mm-hmm. then it becomes publicly known, and that puts your patentability at risk, right?
Right. You try to keep it as within your closed circle as much as possible. The more you disclose it to others, it just raises the risk of it then being, you know, misappropriated by others.
That never happens. No, I'm just kidding.
Never happens. Never
a little bit of sarcasm there, as my mm-hmm. audience knows. So we're going through that process. I get a fairly precise, concise description of the problem, how I'm going to do it, if I have a drawing, what I think it's going to work like mechanically or software-wise or whatever we're doing. And then I need to sit down and really test that.
So it's not necessary that you build a prototype or that you test it out. If you simply have the fully conceived idea, that is often enough. Now, that being said, if you have the ability to build the prototype and the ability to test it out, I think that would always be helpful. It would help you get farther along in the inventive process. But oftentimes that's, you know, financially not feasible, or possibly it's technically not feasible. So the key is just having a fully conceived idea. And once you have that fully conceived idea, as you were mentioning earlier, get on the internet, search through Google patents. Is often a lot more friendly than the USPTO website. That's a good place to start. Just run your regular Google searches, go to Google patents website itself, go to the USPTO website, and you kind of get an idea of what's out there. You can compare it to your idea. And you'll start to get a feeling for how are you differentiating yourself from what's out there. One way we put it is, what are your potentially patentable concepts within your idea? And that's really where we start honing in on what is it we're trying to protect.
And so it might be that the entire invention looks like something else, but what you're actually patenting is some unique portion of it or some unique use of it. So like a mechanical joint, or the way something opens, or the way the electronics work in the circuitry with something else. Those kind of things are the distinctions then within your patent.
That's right. I mean, you can look at the exterior of a car and they all might look the same, but once you get inside, there's hundreds of patentable ideas in there. And so the key is focusing in on what aspect of that is important. It may be as small as you've got a hinge for the car door that works in a particular manner, is shaped in a particular manner that makes it more durable or less likely to squeak or something of that matter.
Well, I know a lot of my clients' patent applications they start as provisionals, right? Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about that process. I have the idea and I have a choice to go provisional, or I have a choice to go full patent. And then what are the types of patents I can file?
So stepping back just a little bit more, there's three different types of patent.
Okay.
There's a utility patent, a design patent, and a plant patent, which we rarely ever see. If you're going to file a plant patent, you're likely already pretty deep into that area of science.
So when we're talking about utility patents, what do those actually cover versus a design patent?
So, right, a utility patent covers the functional aspects of a product or a method or process.
So how something moves, how something functions?
Right. Well, as compared to a design patent, which covers the ornamental aspects. So if I have a, let's say, a table, which we have here, the design patent would cover, say, the ornamental shape of the top.
So whether it's a square, a snub nose, a round nose that has a beveled edge, those kind of things.
The fact that it has legs to support it, that's really not ornamental. That's a functional aspect. Now, the shape of the legs or the curvature it has, that would be ornamental. So that's where the difference lies in. Is the structure we're looking at, is it serving a particular function? Is that why it's designed that way? Or is it for aesthetics?
And it's the appearance. So in a design is more about appearance and how it's perceived when you look at it visually. So, and then utility is how does it actually function?
That's right. So design patents are covering your ornamental design. The utility patent is covering the functional aspects. Most of the time people are coming in for the utility patent.
Right.
That's the most common aspect. And back to that, you have a couple options when you want to move forward to protect your utility design. We were talking about, do you have a fully conceived idea? Oftentimes you have a fully conceived idea, but let's say you're not sure whether or not in this table example we're using, you know, do I want four legs or do I want six? You know, how long is your table? Do the legs need to be really wide or do they need to be really short? How are we going to attach them to the tabletop? Maybe you have some of those answers, those questions answered, but some of the other ones you say, well, it could be X, Y, or Z. In such a case, you have a fully conceived idea, but you do think that going down the road,
there would be other variations.
Right. You're going to experiment a little bit. You're going to vary it. You're going to maybe change it up as the design process and the manufacturing process goes along.
Well, and it's like, here's your idea. And then when you start reducing it to practice, when you start actually making the product, you learn other things.
That's right.
And you learn a different type of material might work, or a different attachment point, or a different, you know, wider at the top, narrower at the bottom, those kind of things, as you're trying to actually take your idea from concept to physical existence.
That's right. And if you see that happening and you see that over the next year you're going to be doing quite a bit of development, a provisional patent application may be your best bet. What a provisional patent application is, in layman's terms, is essentially you're putting a stake in the ground and saying, I was here first, I was here on this date, and here's the information I had. And a provisional patent application, unlike a non-provisional application.
The real one.
The real one, quote unquote.
The real technical term there. The genuine, completely finished, finalized, this is what we're going to send through.
That's right. Okay. That one you're not going to be able to change up, and it's actually going to get examined. Unlike your provisional application, which it gets examined to make sure you meet a minimum bar, but a patent examiner isn't going to pick it up, look at the prior art and compare it to that and give you an examination report. What the provisional does is it stays at the patent office for 1 year, during which time you have time to gather new information, change information. And then by the end of that year, it could be the next day or up to a year, you then convert it to your non-provisional application.
And so in that process and making the decision, because we've made, you know, working with you, we've been making the decisions with the other company, is like, when are we going to do provisional? What do we think we want to change? And then where did we go full? So one invention, we went full bore. We filed the full on patent getting reviewed. Please God, let it be issued soon. And then the other route, we went provisional because we knew in the manufacturing process, we would probably be making changes.
Right.
But we had the placeholder there. And I think, I'm not sure everyone listening would understand that it used to be first to invent had the protection. And I think now it's first to file your patent, correct?
That's right.
So what does that change and what does it mean for the garage inventor? What does it mean for the small business that thinks, well, I invented it. I have all the things here. And then suddenly they see it on TV, right?
That's right. It used to be that you could evict your garage, and so long as you were moving forward with the process and you weren't abandoning your invention, a year or two down the road, so long as you hadn't publicly disclosed it, you could then file your patent application. If somebody had beat you during that intervening time and filed an application as well, you could prove to the patent office, hey, I was here first. Here's my scientific journal. Here's a picture I took.
Right.
And you could provide proof and backdate your date of conception. The patent office in the United States was unique in that aspect. Most of the world was first to file. And so part of the international harmonization of patent laws was the United States moving from a first to invent to a first to file. The first to file means it doesn't matter when you conceived it in your garage. It matters when you filed that patent application.
With the government agency.
Right. So if Joe and Mary both conceived the same thing on two different coasts independently, it doesn't matter which of them conceived it first. It matters who filed it with the patent office first.
Well, and let's talk about that patent filing. So we now know that there are three types of patent: the utility, the design, and for plants.
Mm-hmm.
Which are usually those little scientists and they're creating new hybrids and all
those
kind of things. And then we have the provisional versus the full-blown patent application. But when we're thinking about this process and making the decision, it's often a financial win as to what we do. What can we afford to do to get our place in? So let's say we decide we're going to go for a provisional because of financial issues. It's a little less expensive, or we think we can do it on our own.
Mm-hmm.
We can get a book off of some website, or we can go to some automated thing. And so we decide we're going to go that route, and we're going to be a placeholder. What can be defective about us doing it on our own, putting a provisional in early on, and then it not count for when we finally decide to file the patent?
Yeah, that's a very common mistake. I do see a lot of people try to go to certain online sites or just to file themselves. And filing a provisional by yourself has a lot of pitfalls.
One of my clients talked about it. He goes, oh, it can just be a PowerPoint presentation. And I'm like, maybe.
So technically, that's true, and I think that's where a lot of people make the mistake in believing that they can file it with themselves, because technically you can file almost anything for a provisional. You can scan your napkins that you had on that conversation during dinner and file those in, and it will be accepted and they will give you an application number. But whether or not it is effective in
holding
providing you support is the real question. You know, as a patent attorney, you have to have a legal degree. As a patent agent, you have to pass a patent bar. And that requires learning a couple thousand pages of law. And a lot of the reason for that is there are legal requirements for
what has to be contained to hold that place,
right? To give you, quote unquote, support for your invention.
So, I mean, I couldn't put in a 20-page PowerPoint slide with three words on it and some sketches and it won't hold my place unless it substantially describes the idea that will be patented.
Right. You have to substantially describe the idea. You have to do it in such a manner that you're not shooting yourself in the foot. There are things you can say in that patent application that will actually negate maybe
your patentability.
Your patentability and the particular inventive aspects that you want to claim as your invention down the road. So there's just a lot of pitfalls that you could insert into your provisional application that could cause you trouble down the road. And that's one thing that your attorney is going to help you avoid.
Well, and you also only have a certain period of time, right, from filing the provisional to hold that date where you were first to file with that and then filing the full-blown application.
Right. You have up to a year. So you can file that provisional and
so if I filed it today,
win the lottery the next day, you can you can convert it, you know, 2 days later.
Right.
Or, you know, the next day you make that, you have that eureka moment and everything's solved, you can convert it the very next day. But should that not happen, you have up to 1 year from
So 365 days.
That's right.
And so you, and every month, I always tell my clients, okay, that's fine. You have 365 days, but it's not a 1 day or a 24-hour process to complete all the documentation and things you have to do in the real blown one, full blown one. So you need to allow yourself time to actually sit down, create the whole patent application. And that may be, you may need new drawings. You may need a whole lot of things. So have a timeline that says that 6 months into that 365 days, I need to decide what all has to happen to have all the elements then to actually file.
That's right. I'm glad you brought up drawings. In the provisional, the drawings can be pretty informal. You can have PowerPoints. You can have scans. They can be
pencil sketches.
Pencil sketches. When you get to the non-provisional application, they are much more formal. They have to be black and white line drawings. They have to be labeled a certain way. There's certain margins and shading rules. And so oftentimes what the most difficult or most time-consuming part is getting those drawings to an appropriate place and time. And that
getting the proper format.
That's right. That's right. So as you mentioned, there are good check-in points during that year period where you should do a self-evaluation, say, where am I at? What do I need to do to get there? Check in with your patent attorney and see, you know, where the timeline is heading and how much time is needed to finalize that process before the year deadline.
And so with, like, filing fees, they're kind of on a scale now. I think it used to be just there was one fee for everybody that filed.
That's right.
And now if you're a micro business or you're a small business or you're, you know, Goliath over here and big business, there's different fees for that.
Right. So the default is for everybody to be an undiscounted or large entity. If you are a company with 500 or less employees, that usually applies to most of us, you can be a small entity. And then one step further is a micro entity, which is it applies to universities, some nonprofit institutions, and it applies to individuals. If all the inventors on the application are individuals that are making approximately $155,000 or less per year, there's some there's an asterisk beside that. There's a couple other aspects that go in that. Have you been named on applications before? What is a year? And that number will kind of change based on the average annual income and the poverty line. But that's the general.
But that's one point. Like when we're developing our budget to protect our intellectual property, to do a patent filing. So we need to understand where we're going to fall into that today, what kind of our fee schedule is going to be. We need to get sit down and start talking to some patent attorneys about, well, what does it cost for a provisional? What will that get me? What does it take to do the full-blown patent application? The drawings for things, you know, what's that going to be to get those produced? And so we really need to come up with a budget as well as that timeline as to we think we want to file the patent application, whether it's provisional or full-blown. And then we have to see all those little elements that we have to pull together, the drawings, the patent attorney, the meetings. All of that kind of stuff has to come together, and we have to know what that is.
Well, with most things in life, and just like in patents,
it depends.
It depends. And the two most critical aspects are time and money.
Right.
So finance is usually a pretty big issue with filing a patent application. And it's not only just the filing aspect, but your downstream costs you have to also have to consider.
What are those downstream costs?
Well, typically, with a typical application, we tell a client whatever your quote is on your filing, you're looking at 50% to 75% of that being your downstream cost.
So what you're saying is, like, if I get a quote for $5,000 to file it, I'm expecting probably $3,500 or more to answer the responses and deal with things downstream.
At a minimum, right.
Okay.
So, you know, it could be more expensive, but you're looking at, say, if you file for $5,000, you're looking at $2,500 to $3,500 to get it to allowance. And allowance means the patent office has sent you a letter and said, hey, your claims that describe your invention are allowed. We think you deserve a patent. And then it goes and it issues and registers as a patent.
And so in this process, because I know my clients frequently when they're in the scientific things, they go in and they think, well, I have one patent. We sit down with a patent attorney and it turns into five patents. because of the different utility aspects of it and splitting it out into what it functionally does. How do we make it a determination, and when should we start having those conversations about, is this one patent? I'm making one product, but I may have 20 components in it that could each be patented in their own right because they're new inventions. When should we have that conversation, and who should we have it with?
That is definitely a conversation you want to have with your attorney, who's going to be able to, who has the experience with the patent office and knows when they're going to try to separate your application into different inventions. The patent office requires that each patent is issued on one invention. And so they determine
what constitutes an invention.
What constitutes an invention. And that can be a very technical discussion we probably don't need to do here. Right. And it very much depends on the particular technology that you're dealing with. But that's a discussion you want to have before you file your application, because that's going to impact costs. It's going to impact down the line how you may license or sell your product.
Right.
And you want to determine, you know, what do you want to have protected first? What is the most critical aspect of your inventive concepts? And that's probably what you want to protect first. There's so many options to go down the road and protect multiple inventions. The most common way to do it, though, is you can file one application that covers multiple inventions that all deal with a particular singular concept.
Right.
For example, the multiple different inventions in your table that you've created.
Right.
You file the application, you get claims which define your invention about one particular aspect, and then as you're moving down the prosecution process with that application, you can then carve out another application from that application. You keep your same quote-unquote priority date, which is the date you either file the provisional or non-provisional, and you file a continuation application. And that continuation application is essentially a mirror copy of your
original
application, but with different claims directed to a different inventive concept.
Okay, and so you can easily start multiplying the more non-obvious, I guess, it is your concept and your idea. And so it really is early and often sit down with the attorney and say, this is what's going on. This is my idea or ideas. Because I find most of my clients that are inventors, they always come in with multiple ones and they're coming in. And then we're trying to make the distinction of what's really belonging to this, to one patent application versus the other, because they see it as everything.
Right. I mean, when you file the application, you want to have a clear idea of where you want to be 2 to 3 years from now. The application process can be slow. We're dealing
I've had them anywhere from 7 to 10 years before they were issued with clients.
That's on an extreme long
technical
end.
Yeah, that's extremely technical, scientific
but
items.
It's a government entity, and there's a long wait to get it examined. I mean, the examiner may not even pick up your application for a year after you get it filed before they start reviewing it. There are ways to speed up the process, so we can talk about that if you'd like. Going back to filing the application with multiple ideas, you definitely want to have an idea of where you want to be 2 or 3 years from now. Because once you file that application, once that information is presented to the patent office, you can't change that. It's set in stone. Now, you have the option of filing what's called a continuation in part down the road. That's a whole other set of costs and a whole new application.
So the cleaner you are when you're creating that patent application, the more efficient you are cost-wise, too.
That's right. That's right. You definitely want to play your best hand.
Focus.
right there at the beginning.
Well, and so when we're going through this process, what happens if our patent application is rejected? Can we appeal it? What do they tell us when they reject it? And those kind of things.
So oftentimes when I report to a client that their application has been rejected, they seem dejected.
And, yes.
And I understand that rejection is a pretty strong word. But it's very common for an application to be rejected when it's first picked up. In fact, if I had to take a guess, 95% of the applications are rejected on the first office action,
review,
is what they call
it,
the first review. So the examiner picks it up. They search for prior art. They find the prior art, and they look at it and say, well, if you combine prior art A, B, and C, we've now built your invention. Oftentimes we say, well, we think you missed a couple concepts, or maybe that what you consider an obvious combination isn't so obvious. And we have to kind of teach the examiner up a little bit and get them to a point where they understand the invention a little bit better and understand the prior art a little bit better. And then we often reach a compromise, or where they agree with us, hopefully, without having to compromise too much. But having a first rejection is very common, and it's something that the inventor should expect.
And so you just go through that process doing answering the office actions.
Right.
And that's part of those costs after filing that we were talking about.
That's definitely one of the costs you want to be prepared for is after you file your application, expect the rejection and your attorney having to respond to it. Hopefully you only get one or two rejections, and at that point you've got some allowable material.
Well, and once we have that patent issued, what does it actually mean protection-wise? We're getting a U.S. patent. Does that protect me in Germany or China? And what do I need to know about U.S. patent law and how it protects me versus international?
What does a patent give you? That gives you the right to exclude others. In other words, it gives you a monopoly, a limited monopoly the government has given you. The whole patent process is an exchange. You are granting to the public your knowledge and making it publicly available for everyone to see.
Because it's published.
Right. It's going to be published either during the patent process or upon it registering as a patent. That's right. That publication of the knowledge you've created is granted in exchange for a limited monopoly that the government gives you to exclude all others from making, selling, or using your patented invention in the United States.
How long are we protected by a patent, and does it vary depending on what the patent is and all those kind of things?
That's right. So if you have a utility patent, it's 20 years from the earliest date of filing. And if you have a design patent, it's 15 years from the date of issuance. When I say earliest date of filing for the utility patent, I mean the earliest date of your non-provisional filing. Your provisional filing is essentially a free one-year patent term, and that's another advantage to having that. That early priority date helps you as far as the prior art goes. The examiner has to find prior art before the provisional date, but it doesn't affect your patent term. Now, there's some other small things that can affect your patent term as well, and it can be adjusted up and down depending on how the patent process goes. If the USPTO is slow in some of their responses, it can increase your patent term. If you're slow in some of your responses, it can decrease your patent term.
So if I understand that correctly, if I'm filing a utility patent, it's 20 years from the date I filed the non-provisional, but I have protection if I filed a provisional before that.
That's
so the 20-year date. So if I filed the provisional a year ago today, I still, for art and review, that's great. But the today's date when I filed the non-provisional is where my 20-year start.
That's right.
Okay.
That's correct.
And then on the design one, if it takes 10 years to get through the patent office, I have at least 15 from the time they issue it, if not more, depending on what the delay was.
That's right.
Okay.
That's correct. Another thing you should know about after post-issuance, after the issuance of a patent, is with the design patent, you are granted a monopoly for those 15 years, and it's pretty straightforward. With a utility patent, you're granted that monopoly for the
20 years.
You are required to pay maintenance fees every 3.5 to 4.5 years after the date of issuance. So, in other words, you get a patent today, 3.5 to 4.5 years from now, you have to pay a maintenance fee, essentially saying, hey, patent office,
we're still using this. It's still viable. I haven't abandoned it. It still needs to be kept in force.
That's right. If you don't pay that maintenance fee, you lose your patent exclusivity. And
somebody can start producing.
That's right.
So, again, we need to be aware financially how we're going to budget to keep our IP in place.
That's right.
So, but I have a patent, and then somebody in Washington State, I'm in North Carolina, and I suddenly see them making my product. What do I do?
Call your attorney. Call your attorney, and they're going to investigate a couple issues. First, does that product that they're producing in Washington, does it infringe upon your patent claims? In other words, do the claims in your patent read on that product? And if the answer is yes, then the second question is, what do we want to do about it? Most of the time, what we're going to do is send them a cease and desist letter and say, hey, please stop producing what you're producing.
And then I have to add, I know the financial person in me says, okay, but they've been producing it and selling it for a year. What happens to those revenues that they had from basically illegally producing my product?
So you do. You want to be able to capture that revenue. They've damaged your business, they've taken profit from you, they've unfairly gained from
you.
Right. There's a couple different avenues to pursue. Essentially, this kind of becomes a business decision and a negotiation of sorts. You know, do we want to try to extract licensing fees from? Do we want to reach a settlement outside of court? Are they stubbornly refusing to acknowledge that they're violating anything at that point? How do we want to approach them in court? You know, do we want to sue them for patent infringement? And this is all very case specific at this point, but these are all options to pursue.
And so, again, the patent gives us the right, essentially, to defend our monopoly, mm-hmm. but that takes money one way or the other.
It does.
And so, if we're David and Goliath is the one that violates our patent, we're this little small business and we don't have deep pockets, and we know Goliath has lots of lawyers on retainer, or they actually work for the firm and they can hold this up forever. Can you get an injunction to stop them producing something while it's debated in court? Do they get to just keep running and doing what they're doing regardless? I mean, what are the quickest steps that we could, like, say, stop in your tracks?
That's right. So if Goliath is refusing to acknowledge their infringement of your patent, the one of the opportunities you have to have is to file infringement suit with the court and seek a temporary injunction or a permanent injunction to keep Goliath from continuing down that road of infringement.
Yeah, because by the time, if they are allowed to continue, by the time you got to court, you may not have a business because all your revenues were around those products. And so here's Goliath underselling you potentially because of pricing and all that kind of stuff. And so you really need to be able to protect it, but it comes down to your bottom line and your ability to spend money to protect it.
That's right. I mean, you do have to have the ability to pursue that action in court, particularly when it's a much larger company. Oftentimes, you can approach them, and if it's obvious that they are infringing, they may want to reach a settlement with you instead of making this part of the public
record. Or they just
want to
buy your company.
Or buy your company. Another option that companies have, though, are to then attack your patent. And this is where our previous discussion about filing your own provisional can come back to bite you. If Goliath comes back and says, well, you know, I see that you filed your own provisional. It obviously has some holes in it. And now we want to bring your patent back up to the patent office and have them re-examine that priority date.
Right.
Should you get credit for that provisional you filed? And they're going to try to find holes and poke holes in your provisional.
Well, I've done some expert witness cases related to government-funded research and whether people met all the terms and conditions of that government-funded research in order to actually have been able to patent it and do all those kind of things. And so you get into that really technical detail of, did you file it correctly? Did you file it with all the wording and stuff that was supposed to be on it? And then all of those types of things, so that it is a valid patent. Because I know with the SBIR stuff, there's specific language, Small Business Innovation Research Grants from the government, required to be put on that patent filing because the government filed it and they get a royalty-free interest paid up right to use it. And so you get down to that. And so that was how it was attacked. A Goliath bought a David, but another David was suing, saying, well, that original patent that you just bought isn't a valid patent for all these reasons, that they technically did not comply with this law. They didn't do this. This was defective. And so they were fundamentally attacking that patent and what went through with that process and was it properly filed and all of those kind of things.
That's right. The technical needs of your patent application are very important. And that's, again, why I think that having a patent attorney is very helpful and useful. And
It's worth the investment. It's not an expense.
Right. I mean, you're going to be putting a good bit of time and money into this. You want to be able to do it right.
Well, and if it's your competitive advantage for your small business, and this is what you've been pouring all of your time and your effort and your money into, then it's worth investing in to make sure that now that you've created the invention, that you're actually going to get to benefit from it in the future.
That's right. And one thing we didn't touch on earlier that we probably need to discuss is, before you file the patent application, there's a lot of questions on who is the inventor.
Who's going to come back to that,
the
right?
Inventorship, who owns this? Was there a public disclosure before you filed the application? While here in the United States, you're given a year. So let's say you publish an academic article describing your invention. You have a year from that publication to file in the United States. In other countries, that's not necessarily true. In Europe, for example, once you publicly disclose it, you lose all rights to being able to file a patent.
Well, and a lot of things I see with clients when they come in that there's confusion as to, they have a day job, and it's in the field that they're inventing on. And they forget that they have an employment agreement for work for hire with their employers that says, in my field that they're paying me for to do this, my work product belongs to my employer.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors and analysis that go into that. Each of these employee arrangements with your employer is governed by state law, so this is going to vary from state to state.
Right.
But essentially, you're looking at a couple factors. Did you do this on the company time? Did you use company resources? Is this part of your job description and title? Did you sign an employment contract when you were hired? Or did you sign that contract after you were hired at some point down the road? That makes a big difference.
Well, like with universities, we have a lot of professors that they're there to do research for the university in their field. It's very hard to make an argument that when they're in the lab, practically 24/7 inventing, that they can carve out something as their separate invention from what they're being paid to do for research in their field at the universities.
That's right. And each of these universities, for example, around here, UNC, NC State, Duke, they each have their own intellectual property policies. And sometimes that policy varies depending on your status in the university. Are you an undergraduate student? Are you a graduate student? Are you a professor? And each of those...
And your funding source for those.
Right. And
if you're fully funded as a research assistant for a professor and you're a grad student, there's different rules than if you're just a grad student paying your way.
That's right. Is there a partnership with a private company as well? I mean, there's a lot of analysis that goes into this. Essentially, if you're doing this at home on your own time with your own resources.
And it means not the laptop provided by the university or your employer, because that's the company's resources.
That can be a little hairy too, you know. And also, you know, if you're doing this for a company of yours, you know, are you and your team emailing with a company email? Are you emailing with your own private email? You just want to be very clear in your separation. When the lines are blurred, it doesn't mean you've lost all your rights. It just makes it more difficult and opens yourself up to challenges in the future, which obviously you want to avoid. So if you're going down this road and you see yourself possibly inventing something and you're in a situation where you need clarity, right? You need to pick up the phone, call an attorney, and sometimes they'll be able to walk you through some of the safeguards you can use to protect yourself without having to charge you for that knowledge. Sometimes it's just some quick helpful information.
I have one of the companies I worked with, they weren't here in North Carolina, but they came in, they got an SBIR grant, so they got about $250,000 to do some research, and it was a husband and wife team, and she worked for a Goliath, and he worked for a university, and they were both in the field, and I'm like, have you guys checked your employment agreement? And they're like, well, why would that matter? And I'm like, because what you're describing is what you just told me you did for your bosses during the day. And where's your lab? Well, I use mine at work, and I use mine at work, right? And so they're, you know, suddenly they're getting government funding to do research on something that probably is owned, in this case it did turn out, was owned jointly, ended up being owned jointly by Goliath and the university, because all of the resources had come from those two entities. There was no distinction. Like you said, they used their emails. They went back and forth. I mean, it was just interwoven with everything else they were doing. And then they had the complicating factor of, I'm not even licensed to do this, because that IP is now going to belong to those entities. And it just became this cascading thing, because I think a lot of the professors think, well, I invented it at the university. I can now start a business with it. Not if the university has patent rights, right?
Right. Most universities will have an office of technology transfer that is going to be overseeing a lot of this inventive material done by their professors and grad students and some of their undergrad students. And so oftentimes a discussion is needed between your attorney and that tech transfer office to get a clear delineated line of Which side do you follow?
And I tell my clients, an independent attorney with no conflict of interest. They can't be doing work for the university.
Right.
And the professor. It's not illegal if everyone knows and you can sign off on it, but it's still just not, as far as I'm concerned, a good idea.
That's right. And, you know, there's also some issues on the flip side. Let's say that you're working at home on your own time, you're inventing something, but you don't have the programming skills and you need to hire somebody to help you turn that app into a reality or work on
right.
that user interface or something like that. Well, now you've got to hire somebody. And the question is, you know, at what point do they become an inventor? And at what point do they have any ownership rights? And so you need to work on protecting yourself in those respects, too. And there's a couple of different ways to do that. One is a non-disclosure agreement, which should be used not only with people working on your product.
The people you're talking to.
That you're talking to. That's absolutely right. And then you've got a work-for-hire agreement where somebody has agreed to assign all their rights in any intellectual property they create back to you. So they may be listed as an inventor because they helped you conceive
right.
new ideas, but they don't necessarily have any ownership rights in the application.
So here's a question. When, let's just say you make the patent application, you put yourself down as the sole inventor, but there's somebody around here that did it. Yes, they gave you the intellectual property rights. You're going to own it, but you still have to list them for that to be an accurate technical filing, correct?
That's right. If you fail to list somebody that has contributed to a claim in your invention, then that could render your patent invalid at a later date. They could come back and say, hey, you know, I contributed to this. And you'll say, but you're not an owner. Well, that's true. They're not an owner, but that's
but they are an inventor.
Yeah.
And so we need to know those definitions and be very clear on that could. And I tell clients, I said, when everybody might be fine now, but when the millions start rolling in from the invention, people's perspectives change.
You need to clear up those relationships from the get-go, because no matter how happy it is at the beginning, when money and business gets involved, there's bound to be a little friction and disagreement. So clear those relationships up. Document it all up. Tighten it up with some documents and some signatures. And now that we've established everything, all right, now let's move forward and get this filed and worked on.
And so something else I think clients get confused about is we filed the patent, but they may have created a name for the invention or a logo for it. They said, but I filed the patent. And so how do things that need to be trademarked and things that need to be copyrighted come into play as it relates to, okay, this is covered by the patent, but there may be things related to that invention that need to be covered with the other intellectual property protections?
Right. I mean, generally all of your branding and your naming, that's going to be covered by trademark law. You've got your patent application. You can file it. You don't need a patent to start manufacturing and selling. The patent doesn't give you a right to manufacture and sell. The patent gives you a right to exclude others from manufacturing and selling. So while you're going through that patent process, if you're out there selling the product or offering it for sale, you may have a company name or a brand or a logo you want to protect. And so separately, you need to start looking at, is a trademark right for me? And very similar to the patent process, first step to do is, has somebody else trademarked this name? Before you go buying that website and incorporating your business, run a quick search on, let's say you're in North Carolina, the North Carolina Secretary of State, you go to their website, run a search for the name. Has anybody used this name before? Then you can go on to the United States Trademark Database.
Use PTO and search. Hit the trademark, right.
Right, and search for the trademark. Has somebody used this trademark before? And it's not just the name. It's the name and the class of goods and services you're selling. So somebody can call Google a search analytics firm, but if you want to sell the I was going to say car, but they've got a car now, too. I don't know.
Well, let's say you made an apple. It's a Google apple. You know, like, a fruit that you would eat.
Oh, the fruit, yes.
Yeah. And so you could have a Google apple because they're not protected under a plant. You could name your apple Google.
Right. So your trademark is limited.
I should have picked an orange.
It's going to get pretty confusing using Google
Okay, let's say Google orange.
Right. So, well, essentially, Yeah, your trademark covers a particular class of goods. So if it covers automobiles, somebody can get the same exact name that covers a barbecue sauce.
Right.
So long as they're not confusingly similar in the customer's eye.
Right, and I have a trademark on Technovation Entrepreneur. And so the Technovation part was spelled T-E-C-H and then like the Ovation. There was a company in California, I think it is, that was spelled T-E-K. And the debate then with the trademark office was there going to be confusion?
Mm-hmm.
They were doing apps and software, and I'm not. And so I have the use of Technovation as I have it spelled in pretty much every category that they don't have and with their spelling. But that took some going back and forth, just like it did with the patent, saying,
right.
Well, I think this is too similar. Well, it sounds similar. It doesn't look similar, and we're not practicing it in the same arenas.
Right. The trademark examiner is going to look at couple things, and it's mainly who is the customer you're selling to, and what do they, if you had your two products, are they going to be confused? Not if they're compared side by side, but they saw them
right.
one day and then came in and saw another day. Would they say, hey, are these made by the same company? Is this coming
right.
from the
so
same
like,
source?
So branding books and things versus me having a software program. In this case, I think they actually competed with SAS. It was a technical analytic program. There wasn't going to be no confusion. I'm never going to be having software at that level. And
right.
so it after that discussion, it became like, okay, yes, you're right. They're never going to be confused.
And that's a good point. Another thing that we run into issues with when people want to file trademarks is you can't file a trademark, again, back to the table, called Brown Table to sell brown tables. It's descriptive of the goods you're trying to sell. You need to come up with something that is more what they like to call fanciful or more abstract.
Well, it's like focus resources. I have a service mark on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and it took a little bit of time, but they said, well, I had created a brand around the logo and the name such that it was distinct. And even though focus and resources were commonly used, I have the right to protect that brand and that name in a certain way. And my focus is an acronym.
Right.
And so it made that distinction.
So that's the supplemental register. Essentially, the principal register is where most of the trademarks go. But if you have something that's particularly descriptive, and the patent office is actually tightening up on this a little bit, descriptive trademarks are less likely to get registered now. But if you can show 5 years of use, you can show that you've been using it in a commercial manner for
right.
a significant period of time, then you can move to the supplemental register or you can get it registered and
right.
and still have some protection there.
Well, and
but
it's something else, too, that we have to maintain. Because I
mm-hmm.
just went through, like, I think it was last year, and I had to hit that little window to pay my fees and prove, you know, file the form and said, yes, I need to continue it. It's still in use. Here's the images where it's still in use. And those kind of things. So it's just like a patent. There's
That's
like
right.
six and a half years or some weird window.
6 to 10 years
yeah.
you have to show that you're still using it commercially. And
it's still being used in the same way that it was originally.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things.
Another very important thing is that when you file the trademark, that you do it in the name of the company or the person that is actually using or intending to use the
right.
trademark. If you were to file a trademark for one of your companies and you filed it under your name, the trademark's invalid because it should have been filed in the company's
right.
name. So that's very important to discuss.
Well, and it's things with copyrights too.
That's right.
I mean, because it's like who is going to own the body of work? And some things I copyright in both names, or some things are just strictly copyrighted in my name, like the books. So it's making those decisions. What's going to belong inside of the company? What do I want to own individually? You know, I have over 1,000 articles written. I don't file a copyright on every one of them formally, but legally, just because I produce the work, it's mine.
That's right. So a copyright is unique in that as soon as it's created and published, it is now, you have a common law copyright. Registering that copyright merely gives you additional legal tools down the road.
If somebody photocopies my book, there's damages that can occur.
Right. It helps you with damages. It helps you in your court cases if you register the copyright. If you don't register the copyright, you still have remedies. You can still keep others from copying you, but it makes it a lot easier and allows you to acquire more damages if you do register it.
But we all need to be aware of the intellectual property and the activity that we're engaging in for our businesses, and it's an investment to protect it. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. Your website is
www.nkpatentlaw.com. We'll help you with your trademarks, copyrights, or patents.
Thanks for being on the show, Lyle. And until next time, everyone, stay focused on the important things.
Focus on Business would like to thank our underwriter, Close HR Connections. Ann Close of Close HR Connections has been on the show, and she is a great supporter of WCOM-FM and Focus on Business. Visit their website, closehrconnections.com.
Focus on Business is underwritten by Focus Resources. The website is focusresourcesinc.com.